From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Michael Heiser joins us. Ancient astronauts, his views on the subject. Here's what's happening. Kind of a scary story. Don't panic, though. Newspapers in Britain report that Britain is under siege from airborne flesh-eating bacteria, but it's being denied. It all has to do with a laboratory study on the MRSA bacteria having a high level of antibiotic resistance. The essence of this study is that MRSA does not affect as easily healthy people, but will attack people with lower immune systems. Flesh-eating bacteria. Heavy snow has left at least 11,000 villagers cut off in remote areas of Serbia amid a European cold snap that has now claimed there more than 130 lives. Pennsylvania's Punxsutawney Phil emerged from his lair to see his shadow, in the process predicting six more weeks of winter. But in most states, winter hasn't even started yet. It's been very mild. Taco Bell being investigated by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for involvement in salmonella outbreak that has apparently sickened now 68 people in 10 states. Food expert Steve Schenck with us. Steve, how does this salmonella happen so often?
Well, very simply, George, it's just a matter of the contamination chain. You have animal byproducts and things being used right now. And one of the things that they're doing is that they're including, they say that a couple of experts indicate that 70% of the ground beef is what they call pink slime. This was coined by a chef by the name of Jamie Oliver on his show Food Revolution. But very simply, what it is, it's made from the parts of critters that are, as the Department of Agriculture indicates, most likely to be infected. And so what they do is they soak it in ammonium hydroxide, and very simply, salmonella, E. coli particularly, comes from feces, poop, as it were. And so what the Department of Agriculture says, that it's perfectly safe if you soak it in ammonium hydroxide to use waste material.
Oh, my God.
And they make a bunch of hamburger from it.
Steve, as consumers, what do we do to try to prevent things like this? I mean, are we just innocent victims and there's nothing we can do?
Well, basically, if you don't control your food, your food will control you. I mean, this outbreak that you're talking about is just minor compared to what we've heard. As you know, George, yeah, you and I have talked from time to time about huge recalls of ground beef, huge recalls of vegetables and fruits even. And what happens is that, very simply, the best protection is you realize that food can't carry these items if it's dry. That's one of the reasons that the food that you talk about so often on your show is in a dry form, and it can't retain any of these critters that cause the illnesses and things. And so what people have to do is they have to take control of their food supply, basically, and hopefully have some dried food in, and don't bet. Basically, when you bet your life on just assuming that food out there is not contaminated, even the dry foods that are out there have some chemicals and some additives that are extremely dangerous to the human body. So people need to be aware of what is in the stuff they're eating. Dry food, as you've told people, is oftentimes the safest from some of these recall-type critters that are causing problems. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, why is 70% or possibly 70% of the ground beef this awful that is actually trimmings that have to be actually decontaminated? And the reason is that for economic reasons, they're taking more and more of the cuts of meat that used to be just ground into hamburger and making them into prime cuts.
Jeez, huh?
And so we've got a constant vigilance that every human being on the planet right now has to be concerned with regard to food contamination. It's just very serious.
Sure is. Steve, thanks for your insight into all this. Steve Schenck. The average rate on the 30-year fixed mortgage fell again to a record low, the ninth time this has happened in the last year. And even with the cheapest rates in history right now, the housing market still remains depressed. A mortgage buyer, Freddie Mac, said that the rate on the 30-year loan dropped to 3.87% this week. Something is happening between Israel and Iran. We've been talking about it for months now on this program. U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has now come to the conclusion that there is a growing likelihood that Israel could attack Iran sometime this spring in an effort to destroy its suspected nuclear weapons program. Jerry Corsi's been a guest on our program for years, and Jerry, you and I have talked about the possibilities of this happening. What do you think?
Well, I think, George, it's getting more and more likely, more and more imminent. In the last 24 hours, it's not only Podesta. We've had the U.S. Defense Secretary saying a war, an Israeli preemptive strike is likely in the spring, but also Israel's defense minister, Ehud Barak, issued a warning in Israel that Israel may need to attack Iran before it's too late. There's this concern that as Iran continues to develop its nuclear program, that it becomes immune from attack, that it deeply buries its nuclear program. It's more difficult to have a strike that would be successful. And as Israel looks at that, says there's a window here where Israel is going to have to strike. And Podesta described that as the spring. It's the first time in years. I mean, George, we've been talking about this coming and predicting it since 2005.
That's right.
Now Podesta is putting a time on it this spring, you know, March, April, May.
Why would he say this, Jerry?
It was really startling today. I've got to admit, George, that's a very good question. When I read that today on the Internet, I was shocked that the U.S. Defense Secretary would actually put a date to when Israel was going to attack. But I think it's because it's so imminent. It's so being discussed in defense circles. And Iran now is saying, well, we'll go back to negotiations. We'll have the International Atomic Energy Agency come in and inspect Iranian nuclear facilities. But that's just a negotiating strategy to gain time. Mm-hmm. Iran's done this over and over again. And, George, I've got to remind listeners that we, you know, anything that can be done to prevent a war, this is going to be a catastrophic war, unpredictable. There's going to be thousands of people killed.
This is not going to be like Iraq sending crummy Scud missiles into Israel. The Iranians have technology.
That's right. And it's not a computer game. Things are going to go wrong. There's going to be thousands of people killed. The best solution has always been, George, peaceful change within from Iran. And in 2009, we missed the opportunity with the Green Revolution in the streets in Tehran. We should have supported that.
Yeah.
Say we want to change the regime. Now we're faced with the prospect of war. And, George, I pray it's not going to be as catastrophic as I fear, or that it could be avoided. But I think it's inevitable, despite all we've done to try to prevent it.
And, Jerry, let me ask you a quick question. You have a broken story here on WorldNet Daily, WND, about the bank HSBC apparently laundering money for some major companies. But briefly, just tell me what have you uncovered here?
Well, George, I've got a whistleblower from HSBC. I've got 1,000 pages of internal documents from the bank, which shows a systematic pattern of money laundering, where the bank at the top level, senior management, is involved. And this, I think, is going to be a story which will develop over the next few days. But I think it shows criminal activity and money laundering that is going on in the drug trade, possibly terrorism, maybe even diversion of stimulus money into illegal activity and being siphoned off.
Amazing.
And going through bank marketing.
All right. We'll talk more about this one, Jerry. Thanks. Jerry Corsi. Abnormalities in the brain may make some people more likely to become drug addicts, according to scientists at the University of Cambridge. They found the same differences in the brain of addicts with their non-addicted brothers and sisters. The study, published in the journal Science, suggesting now that addiction is in part a disorder of the brain. Now, Do you have an important final exam coming up? If you're in school, would do better if you chew gum for about 5 minutes before the exam. No more. Psychologists conducted a study that showed that students who chewed gum for 5 minutes before taking a test did better on the test than non-gum chewing students. They called it masticification of induced arousal, whatever that means, accredited for the boost, which lasted for about the first 20 minutes or so of testing. But they say it's only good if you chew gum for 5 minutes. If you do it beyond that, the effects just don't last. An Oklahoma girl has become an online star because of her ability to say any word backwards in seconds. Alyssa grins shyly on a YouTube video as her friends explain anyone can say a word to her and she can say it backwards within 3 seconds. Let's listen in.
Okay, guys, you're going to have to help me with words.
Okay, Alyssa, anyone can say a word to her, any word. She can say it backwards within 3 seconds. All right, let's go, sis.
Chevrolet.
Telerubic.
Fireworks.
Scrubber roof.
Savings.
Spinavaz.
Gallon.
Nolag.
Download.
Day all in one.
Lamborghini.
Huh?
Lamborghini.
And I rug them out.
They asked her the last one, Lamborghini. Almost stumped her, but you got it right. Amazing. What are the Russians up to? After 20 years of drilling, a team of Russian researchers close to breaching the prehistoric Lake Vostok, which has been trapped beneath the Antarctic for a number of years, 14 million to be exact. But what do they want? Up next, Thomas Grinius joins us. We're going to find out on Coast to Coast AM. Now, let me tell you about something. You know, we talk about the weather all the time and how nice it's been in most parts of this country. But I'm telling you, this month, eventually, something's going to happen, and it's going to be big. And you might want to be ready with the CC Solar Observer by C. Crane. It is perhaps the best emergency radio out there. It's got a built-in hand crank, solar panel for power, runs on a couple batteries, AM, FM, and weather radio. It's got a built-in flashlight. You won't be in the dark, and it's only $49.95. I have said this once, and I'm going to say it again. Every home in North America should have at least one CC solar observer just put aside. Look, you can use it every day if you want to, just to listen to the radio, shows like this. But you should have an emergency radio. You can call C. Crane and order it. Mention my name, 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. They've got several hundred available to ship right now. Or if you also want to look at some of the great things that C. Crane has, the CC Radio 2, the CC Radio EP, the little tiny SW Pocket, and all the other great things, just go to their website, ccradio.com. Well, he's author of the book Raising Atlantis, Thomas Grinius with us, founder and CEO of Atlantis Interactive. That's a company that's been creating some of the web's most groundbreaking entertainment, including the very popular Atlantis Mapping Project, as well as, of course, the best-selling ebook, Raising Atlantis. Tom is a former journalist and executive, and here he is back on Coast to Coast with an incredible story of what the Russians might be looking for near a 14-million-year-old Antarctic lake. Thomas, welcome back. How have you been?
Great, George. Thanks. Glad to be back.
My pleasure. What are they looking for there?
Well, you know, strangely enough, they officially say they're looking for aliens. They really are.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Like deep down below?
Yeah, they're saying they're searching for extremophiles. Those are life forms that can survive in just super extreme environments. And the hope is that that finding them will help them locate life forms on other planets, specifically sending probes out, let's say, to Jupiter's Europa or Saturn's moon Enceladus. And if they can find them in Antarctica, they figure they can find them in seabeds on other planets.
Well, they might be right about that, Thomas. What do you think?
Yeah. I think that's true, and I think, more importantly, they're going to find a good snapshot of Earth before humans populated it. So they're kind of going to see what Earth looked like the first 5 days of Genesis, and the hope is that they won't actually pierce some sort of cosmic seal there and unleash some ancient microbes that wipe us out.
Well, they're digging through a couple miles worth of ice there.
They've been doing it for 20 years. And right now,
wow.
20 years, and they are now only 328 feet away.
That's been a slow drill.
It has. You know, well, they've been stopped a few times by the U.S. Antarctic Commission because of these environmental concerns. The idea is that what happens if that drill contaminates this 14-year-old ecosystem? Vice versa, what happens when that 14-million-year-old ecosystem contacts our environment?
Yeah, that's true.
So they've come up with a gizmo that they say will allow them to sample the lake without contaminating it.
Is this lake that pristine in that, of course, it hasn't been touched in 14 million years, but so pristine that they don't have any idea what might be there?
They have no clue. It's been there that way, sealed off. There are other lakes in Antarctica where the Brits and the Americans are also drilling, but those are more active lakes that are better connected to ancient waterways that have been active. Lake Vostok is really on its own, and it has been that way for a long, long time.
I suspect, Thomas, that they might also be looking for something else. What do you think?
Obviously. I think that if you look at the big picture of Antarctica, it's always come down to rare earth minerals and the deposits that can be found there. It started right after World War II, Operation High Jump, a lot of U.S. Naval exercises there, the Russians, the Chinese got down there. You know, Antarctica isn't owned by any one country, and yet a number of countries make claims. And what they're really looking for are some of these minerals that are rare because the locations of these deposits are rare, and they are rare in exploitable forms. And this is all related to high tech and America's reliance on a supply chain that has been threatened by China's chokehold on these materials. I mean, these are things that you can barely pronounce them, whether it's scandium, which is used for aerospace components, praseodymium for magnets and lasers, promethium for nuclear batteries. This is stuff that you just don't find at the local quarry. So the Russians, Chinese, and U.S. have been in this chess game for a long time down there. And recently, the Russians made a really bold move in the Arctic to lay claim to a seabed. So this is an issue that's not going to go away because it's an issue of national security. And the U.S. and other countries are looking for any new supplies that they can find of these deposits so that we don't end up in some sort of conflict and all the factories and the refineries in the Far East suddenly, you know, shut down as far as we're concerned.
Thomas, how much of what is going on right now echoes your book, Raising Atlantis?
Well, you know, you and I talked about this almost 6-7 years ago,
yeah.
This exact scenario. And the difference is that back then, nobody would officially acknowledge it. The National Science Foundation, which now admits, yes, there have been anomalies they've detected near Lake Vostok. Yes, we've used military personnel to build secret U.S. bases. Yes, there are some geothermal vents and volcanoes that threaten the ice pack. Now those are public, thanks to shows like yours, books like Raising Atlantis, and the Internet, where there's some discussion where, at this point, they can't really hide that. They can only spin it. So it's absolutely possible that the way you cover up the search for these mineral deposits, ancient ruins, whatever, is you actually allow stories about, hey, we're looking for aliens, to dominate the headline.
Yeah, and it works.
It works. I mean, look, we've all been looking at Facebook this last week in terms of their IPO, and we completely missed the combination of two of the biggest mining companies in the world, Glencore and Xstrata. I mean, to get combined, they're $88 billion. They play right into what I'm talking about. That's about the value of what Facebook's about the same, they expect. But we aren't looking at these combinations and the consolidation of the minerals and mining companies. We're looking at social networks.
Thomas, I have always heard rumors that there might be cities under Antarctica and also UFO bases and all kinds of strange things. Have you?
I hear a lot of things, and I hear a lot that, you know, as far as the UFOs, I have not seen it, but I will tell you this. There are a lot of guys from the U.S. Antarctic Mission down there on the military side who do give me a lot of strange reports about a lot of lights and vehicles coming down and going up that are not on the manifest, not on the flight plans. Very interesting. In terms of ancient cities, we do know for a fact that East Antarctica is an ancient landmass. It was once tropical. There are maps like the 1513 Piri Reis map that show the underlying geography under the ice.
Yeah, there's landmass there. It's not all ice, right?
It's not like the Arctic, which we're worried about it melting because of global warming. No, if the ice melts in Antarctica, you've got a new continent as far as habitability. So as we discussed with Raising Atlantis, when it comes to an actual location for an Atlantis, if you took Plato's account in the 4th century BC literally, the only location that fulfills his description is Antarctica. And you can actually see it from satellite overheads of the Southern Hemisphere.
Thomas, I'm going to keep you for some phone calls. Lots of folks interested in some of the things you do. Thomas Grinius, our guest, his book, Raising Atlantis. So we're talking about the Russian drilling program going on in Antarctica. And also, what does this mean for the search for life in outer space? Well, of course, you know, we have the Coast Insiders Club, and my goal every month, add 2,000 new subscribers to the club, new members to the club for less than 25 cents a day. So I needed 2,000 of you to become members of the club in January, and we didn't hit 2,000. We hit 5,083. Thanks. So we're into another month, February. Here we go. Let's get rolling. 2,000 new members of the Coast Insiders Club for less than 25 cents a day. And trust me, you'll have a great time with podcasting, downloads, and just being part of the show. And we shall be right back with your calls. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Thomas Grinius with us. He is, of course, the author of Rising Atlantis. We're going to go to your calls in just a moment. Give us a little synopsis, because I'm sure the book is still available, Thomas. Tell us about Rising Atlantis.
Well, Raising Atlantis is about this secret U.S. military expedition that discovers ancient ruins 2 miles beneath the ice, and the rogue American archaeologist and beautiful Vatican linguist who have to unlock the secret origins of humanity in order to save our future.
Excellent. And it's Raising Atlantis. I said Rising,
yes,
a couple of times.
Raising Atlantis. It's been translated in a couple of dozen languages, sequels, everything else. It's going strong.
Of course, Rising Atlantis would have been neat too, huh?
Yes.
Get it up there. Let's go to Daniel in Reno, Nevada. Welcome to the program. Go ahead, Daniel.
I was just curious. What if you guys find something that's kind of dangerous? I was watching The Thing the other day, and you guys bring up something, and it has a disease.
Exactly, Daniel. That's one of the concerns, that they might kick something up, Thomas.
Well, I don't think we'd know about it until people stop.
It was too late.
Start dropping dead in airports, but you can be sure that they're going to look at it very closely, and the international community may well put a stop to this drill that's 300 and whatever feet away, 328.
Would you stop it if you had the say-so?
Yeah, absolutely. You tell me if you believe that their theory is going to work. Here's the theory of how they're going to penetrate a 14-million-year-old ecosystem and not have it make contact with us, okay? They're going to drill down as soon as they can. They're going to try to do it, you know, before the winter kicks in. And remember, right now it's summer in Antarctica.
That's right.
But they're going to go down to about 65 feet, maybe 100. But they won't go all the way through. And then they're going to use what they call a thermal lance, which is basically it's a high-tech version of putting a needle over a lighter, sterilizing it, and then they're going to penetrate it.
Like burn their way through.
That's right. And so the idea is that as soon as they hit that water trapped beneath, that kind of like a Coke bottle that's been shaken up, it's going to be like a geyser. So as soon as they hit it, the pressure is going to shoot water up, and it is so dang cold, it's going to freeze instantly.
On the way up.
On the way up. And then they will come back a year later and take a sample, a core sample of that column that shot up, so that theoretically they really aren't going into the lake. They're taking the water that shot up. But at some point, I mean, clearly the tip of that lance will introduce whatever microbes or anything else we have, as much as they try to sterilize it, into that ecosystem. And certainly whatever shoots up and that we defrost is going to have its own issues.
What do you think the temperature is of the water underneath the ice? Obviously more than 32 degrees Fahrenheit, but what could it be?
It's
40, 50?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty cold. And again, they're looking for, you know, extremophiles.
So there's something living down there. There's no doubt in my mind.
There's no doubt. And again, whatever the real interest is that because so many million years have passed, without that ecosystem sustaining the kind of climate changes the rest of the world has, what happened to those life forms there? Are they the same? Have they changed? You know, theoretically, they've evolved over 14 million years.
Well, the water underneath the Antarctica is not, like, contained, is it? So can't these creatures, like, just swim out and keep going?
Well, my own theory is that there have to be some, again, you know, some geothermal vents or other things under that lake. But the scientists who are looking at it really believe that it is pretty isolated, that it is basically a bowl filled with water and whatever was there frozen.
And what's on the other side of the bowl?
That's a good question.
Huh. Fascinating. That's a lot. That's a huge mass of land, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, it's not quite Australia, but, you know, it'd be an eighth continent.
And we're talking about what, the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific, the Indian Ocean, everything is surrounding it, isn't it?
That's right. Just like Plato's description, again, which is another reason why Antarctica is the only landmass that fits the bill. It's surrounded by a world ocean, you know, that southern ocean. If you go to traditional sites like Santorini in the Mediterranean, you know, the Mediterranean Sea isn't really a world ocean. And even then, they knew that beyond the Pillars of Hercules was the Great Sea. So, you know, that kind of knocks that out of competition.
Charleston, South Carolina, Ryan's turn east of the Rockies. Ryan, go ahead.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, Ryan.
Great. All right, I had a quick question. First, you kind of touched on part of it and with the finding the tropic forest underneath the Arctic. And you got to ask yourself, how in the world does a tropic condition force make it under the Arctic? And a polar shift would actually cause something like that. And it was described as the Earth crosses the galactic plane, that a polar shift would occur. And it happened, correct me if I'm wrong, around the time that Atlantis was missing. And it would explain, you know, what happened to Atlantis. But are the Russians digging? I kind of view this lake as a time capsule. And if the Russians are trying to dig down for proof for, you know, the treasures in time, inside this time capsule to figure out if it was a polar shift or if it was Atlantis or whatever they do find.
Oh, sure. And I mean, that was the premise of raising Atlantis, that it was a polar shift, that just like Einstein believed that the ice age that hit Antarctica, it wasn't really a meteorological event, but a geological event, that the Earth's crust, like the skin of an orange, shifted so that Antarctica, which was near the equator, suddenly found itself, you know, where the South Pole is, and was almost instantly buried in ice. And that underneath that ice, again, you would find a lot of tropical vegetation, and they have. And that that was the gist of raising Atlantis, is there's going to be another polar shift, and hence Atlantis will be raised when the ice melts and you see what's under there. I think the Russians, you know, are looking at Lake Vostok as, again, that time capsule that you mentioned, and hoping to find I think it's more of the life forms that they're looking for frozen there that they won't find on the desolate ground of East Antarctica. I mean, it's basically a desert. People forget that it's got a pretty high elevation, and it's a it was kind of a desert climate by the time the ice came, but the edges were quite tropical.
There's a little information about Antarctica. It takes up 8.9% of the Earth's land mass. It is now 35 degrees below zero Fahrenheit there right now, minus 35 degrees. The number of countries are taking some territorial claims: Argentina, Australia, Chile, France, New Zealand, Norway, the United Kingdom. I assume you have to throw Russia into that as well, Thomas, don't you think?
Well, what's interesting is that Russia and the U.S. have official claims in the Arctic, but they don't in Antarctica. Yet they have fielded the largest presence of personnel of any countries.
Next up, we go to our first-time caller, Jerry, in Spokane, Washington. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I'm a long-time listener, and I had a two-part question for you.
All righty.
The first part was, how big is the lake? And the second part, won't the water be a lot purer and everything compared to, since it's been under for 14 million years, compared to what we have now with all the pollution and everything?
How big's the lake, Thomas?
You know, off the top of my head, I am missing that.
It's pretty big.
It's pretty huge. Big. I mean, we're talking, you know, Great Lakes huge, but not quite Lake Michigan, but it's pretty big.
And what about the water? Is it fresh water in there?
Actually, the water is hyper-oxygenated. So that's another reason why there's some interest in it in terms of the marine life or other life forms that could live under there. So it's actually much, much richer in oxygen.
Could there be creatures there that we've never seen before?
The assumption is absolutely. So the question is, what kind of creatures are they, and what does it mean if you release them? And it gets to, again, are there microbes? I mean, suddenly do you end up having some airborne sort of thing, or is it you get some, you know, Leviathan kind of crazy worms? You never know.
Could they find German submarines there, or is that just too far-fetched?
Well, I mean, there was a German base there. That's also, in the books, because the Nazis, Hitler had this idea that he wanted to prove the Aryan race was superior. So he sent a lot of his SS people in search of Atlantis because he wanted to prove a link between the Atlanteans and the Aryan race. And they actually ended up in Antarctica, and the rumors are that the U.S. discovered biotoxins there. That the Germans' germ warfare unit and others, that's where they stored them after dropping off some Nazis who escaped Berlin during the fall and, you know, dropping them off in Argentina.
Let's go to Arlington, Virginia, and it's Mike's turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, Michael.
Great. You know, you had mentioned information that you had gleaned from some military folks that were out there, and I'm a former paratrooper and a retired Los Angeles police officer. And actually a former federal agent that I just retired. And so I'm living out here on the East Coast. And the reason I ask
is great.
That...
Thank you.
Thank you. But I've got one of these unique situations where I've had to live life with a foot in two boots, as it were. In other words, I have had, especially recently, major, major sightings. And I've got them on videotape. And so there's no question in terms of, alien life on the planet and visiting the planet, and of course in the Arctic and the Antarctic. And I've managed to get some hardcore evidence, but my entire life, my professional life, I've been reduced to some serious secrecy only because I would have been ridiculed, and who knows, it probably would have cost me my career. And now that I'm free, I mean, I've spent the last week putting up a website with videotapes that I've taken of alien life, and I'm just wondering, when you're dealing with the military people that you say you talk to, how are they? I'm wondering if you're getting the full story, and I'm wondering if there's not any thought about a potential system that could be put in place where folks that are on these missions and people that are in the know could have an anonymous way to get information out, because I can tell you that I'm not the only person that's been in the law enforcement field who has information. You know, I've got a lot of colleagues that think I'm insane for putting stuff up on YouTube and putting my website out and everything. But at this point, I really don't care anymore. And I think that we're on the verge of full disclosure. But I do know that there's a lot of people that are kept quiet because, you know, you still got to pay the bills at the end of the
day. Well, absolutely. And, Mike, I want you, first of all, to email me your website. I want to look at it and see if possibly we should link it at coasttocoastam.com. Well, what do you think about all this, Thomas? Whistleblowers and the right to know?
Well, I do think we have the right to find out. I don't know if what we'll know. But as you've mentioned before, I mean, the government isn't in the business of disclosure. And certainly when it comes to the military, you know, frankly, one of the toughest things about the war on terror has been that so much information is siloed. So that you've got people in law enforcement or the military, and they're—I mean, they could literally, or you've got married couples who just work in different departments, and they just don't—they don't share information. So, you know, as far as the you know a boot in each camp, what makes it tough is that you only get part of the story, and you also have agencies that kind of work across purposes. So you can put it up, but they won't validate it. And others, you know, the people who end up investigating things or filing reports, dismissing sightings, things like that, those often get scrubbed. And people, you know, as was said, you know, they just want to serve their country, and this is just not worth it. You know, they're not going to find their answers, so they're not going to dig. After they're gone, they can, you know, if they've left the service, they can certainly tell their stories, and they have, you know, for years. Again, as far as the credibility, you're not going to see, you're certainly not going to see the government rush to report them and suddenly release all these, you know, all this evidence. And I think the example that I would use, what you will tend to find, however, are disclosures that disclose something else. For example, in the late 1990s, Bill Clinton released for the first time satellite overhead imagery of Antarctica that the U.S. had been taking for a number of years. And it was touted as this big disclosure, transparency. The interesting thing was that it just raised questions. Why are we dedicating satellites
there?
To over Antarctica. And also, how come it only went up to like 1965? They would not release anything beyond that.
That's right. What did they see?
Yes. And or what are we doing down there that we don't want anyone to see? So I think, you know, it is a very complex issue in terms of information. The government is not in the information, you know, this, you know, they're not the news media, and they like to use the news media as PR or to give their spin. So I don't think we're going to find anything until, you know, they are ready to make some disclosures. But again, as we said before in the program, these days there's not a lot you can hide, so they tend to spin it in different ways. But I think you will also find that there are a lot of hacking issues going on from Russia and China that into our systems that have also made the government paranoid about where information resides. So they're just being even more protective than ever.
Good point. Let's go next to Gary, Oceanside, California. First time caller. Gary, go ahead.
Well, hello there, George. How are you today?
Good. Thank you.
I just wanted to comment on your, this is the first time I've called, I've listened to your show quite a bit, and the gentleman that was just on, to me, he should be like a guest, or he should be kept in contact.
Oh yeah, if he sends me the info we need, I'll be in touch with him.
He sounds like he's got a wealth of information, and you know, this story's got to get out there in the public, I think.
Yep, I agree.
And this is a great forum for it.
Anyhow, I just wanted to call and say thank you for all the information you give, and it's very enlightening all the time.
Indeed, indeed. We're almost out of time, Thomas. Would you give out your website and tell us again about Raising Atlantis and where people can get it?
Sure. The website is thomasgrenius.com, but you got to spell it right. That's GRENIAS.com, or you just put Atlantis.mobi, as in mobile, Atlantis.mobi will also get you there. And Raising Atlantis and all my books are available on, you know, Amazon and bookstores, wherever. And the latest one, interestingly, because you brought the topic up at the beginning of the hour, The War Cloud, actually deals with this issue of our vulnerability in terms of the cloud, what the Chinese are doing, and what the Israeli-Iranian, you know, airstrikes might mean.
Well, those drums are thumping, no doubt. Thomas, thank you so much. Up next, Mike Heiser joins us, author of the book, The Facade. We shall be back.